And welcome back to Regionally Speaking with your host, Dee Dotson. Hosted by the NWI Food Council, the new documentary film, The Working Hungry, will be shown throughout the region during the month of April. The film screening will be followed by lunch and a discussion with community leaders about food insecurity and hunger in the region. The NWI Food Council, along with its local farm and food hub, Region Roots, cultivates a just, thriving, and regenerative food system for all in Northwest Indiana. The nonprofit seeks to address issues such as hunger and limited food access. Joining us today to talk about the events as well as the organization is the NWI Food Council Co-Executive Director, Virginia Pleasant, as well as Becca Tucholsky, the organization's Local Food Access Coordinator. Ladies, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks for having us.
Ladies, so it's been a while since we've had a chance to speak about NWI Food Council on Regionally Speaking. And before we talk about some of the exciting events you have planned throughout Northwest Indiana, please take a moment to tell us about your organization's genesis.
The Northwest Indiana Food Council is a grassroots organization that seeks to cultivate a just, thriving, and regenerative food system for all in Northwest Indiana. And in plain speak, what that means is that we are here to serve farmers and help make farms in our region more viable, while at the same time improving food access throughout our region.
Virginia, so I understand NWI Food Council recently launched a new food hub. Take a moment to talk about Region Roots and how it helps farmers with supply chain management. And I understand the pandemic had a helping hand to propel this food hub that had been in the works for some time, right?
Yeah, it sure did. So Region Roots Local Farm and Food Hub is in its second year of operation and really came about as a result of the pandemic. In 2020, when all the grocery store shelves were bare, we saw a lot of the farmers in our region coming together, working together to move food around the region between farms and to offer food to their community members at their farm stands and through their e-commerce. And we sat back for a moment and really tried to think about how we could help them so that they weren't spending so much time texting each other and invoicing each other and all of those pieces that took time away from their being able to grow food. And we said, you know, this logistics piece, this is something that we can really step in and help with. And so that is where Region Roots was born. We exist online. We don't have a giant warehouse. We operate on a just-in-time model. And what that means is that all of our orders come in on Tuesday. And on Thursdays, we drive all around the region picking up food and dropping it off. It is a wholesale-facing hub. So all of our customers are either other farmers or restaurants. And we're starting to move into schools and healthcare a little bit as well.
So, Virginia, you were just speaking about logistics for farmers, right? So let's talk about the stresses as well as the struggles that come with owning a farm. Now, Becca, when I think about farming, I often think about that nursery rhyme, "Old MacDonald had a farm." And I begin to smile as I think about those childhood memories that I have of playing farm with my friends and my sibling. But farming can be quite turbulent when you factor in things such as weather, supply costs. It's labor intensive. And to be honest, I don't think people really understand that farmers don't make a boatload of money doing it. So walk us through the daily life of a farmer, particularly the life of a small farmer, much like the members that are a part of NWI Food Council's Region Roots.
I am actually going to let Becca take that one because she is a farmer. So I think can speak to farmers better than I can.
Absolutely. So my husband and I own a small diversified produce farm in LaPorte, Indiana called Tucholsky Produce. And this is something that's very much on the side for us. It's not our full-time job, but my husband is a teacher at the local high school. So he has the summers off, and then with having a remote position with the food council, I also have some flexibility there, so we're able to make it work. But previously, we've sold at farmers markets in the area. We've also operated a CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture, where participants can join our program and receive a food box through the growing season each week. So as a farmer, and I would say this is true, especially for a lot of small farmers, we tend to take on all the roles. So not only are we, you know, farm owner and operator and grower and harvester, we're also the delivery driver and the front-facing person when we're working with the community. And so it's a lot to take on. And Region Roots is a big help with that as far as taking some of that stress out of the work in terms of delivery and making those connections with area chefs and food service providers.
So Region Roots recently received a Ready grant from the Northwest Indiana Forum. Can you share the amount of that grant, but more importantly, share what that funding will be used for and how it will help local farmers?
I should know that number right off the top of my head. And I don't know the exact number, but it is in the ballpark of around $1 million, which is a lot of money. What that is going to do for us is allow us to take care of our staffing needs for the next 5 years without having to worry about constantly seeking grants or increase our sales. So it gives us 5 years to get off the ground as a food hub that's operated as a nonprofit. As a nonprofit food hub, we charge a lower markup, and we also enable our farmers to take 100% of their asking price. We are not coming there and telling them what price they're going to get. They tell us what price they need, and we apply a much smaller markup than what the industry standard is. So this grant allows us to keep operating in that way that is farmer-driven and farmer-centered and elevates and prioritizes the needs of farmers above all else, because without them, we don't have food, right?
So, Becca, we're speaking about your organization, NWI Food Council, but we're also speaking about farmers. So make the case. Why should our listening audience support local farmers?
By supporting local farmers, you're supporting our local food system. That ties into a lot of things as far as getting healthier, fresher food into our communities, helping to reduce supply chain issues that we see at the national level. We're supporting the local economy by supporting our local farmers and buying local.
So what we see with supporting all local businesses in addition to farmers is that more of that money really stays in the community, which helps us all to grow together. We say often at the Food Council that a rising tide lifts all ships. And, you know, in addition to the better nutrition, the fresher food, the better taste, we're really building a community around local food and strengthening those ties that used to be there in previous years or generations, as it were. So keeping some of that money in the community and helping everybody to grow together, I think, is a big motivator.
Well, that's interesting. And in preparing for our interview today, I read some stats that I found quite staggering. And it said something to the effect of over 90% of the food that we eat is actually imported. And when you think about Indiana being an agricultural state, that's quite staggering, right? Considering that even if a small fraction of that was spent with local farmers, right? Was kept here in the state and certainly in the region and was spent with local farmers, right?
Indiana imports 90% of its food and 98% of its fruits and vegetables, which really is an alarming statistic when you consider the fact that Indiana ranks in the top 10 for agricultural production. The disconnect there is that we rank in the top 10 for a lot of commodity production that is exported out of the state. So we're exporting into supply chains and into processing chains rather than growing a lot of table food, which is where that, you know, the fruits and vegetables might lie as table food. So yeah, if we shifted even 10% in our region, even 10% of purchasing power to local farms and food value chains, we would be looking at bringing in about $1 billion of revenue annually in our region, which is a staggering number and has the potential to have a ripple effect around other industries in our region as well. Northwest Indiana has always, to some extent, exported its food. Historically, it was a lot closer, though. We were exporting into Chicago markets to help supply them. So there's a real opportunity there by supporting local, by even just asking where your food comes from. If you go out to eat at a restaurant, if you're not someone that cooks at home, ask the chef, ask the server if they're buying from any local farmers. because the more that local businesses and community members start to hear this and talk about this, the more demand is created and we're able to advance the conversation more quickly, build a stronger food system in the region.
Wow, again, just think about what that would mean for the economy in the region. Now, in the time that we have left together today, I understand that the NWI Food Council, in partnership with NWI Community Action, as well as the PAC Center, are hosting film screenings around the region to raise awareness about food insecurity. Tell us about the events, and if you can, give a sneak peek of what attendees can expect.
Sure. So we received a grant from Indie Hunger Network to host these screenings throughout Northwest Indiana. And the documentary film, which is called The Working Hungry, is focused on three different families throughout Indiana who struggle to put food on the table. And this is representative of the stories of more than 700,000 people across our state who deal with food insecurity and hunger. So through our screenings, our first one is going to be on April 19th in Rensselaer. We have another on April 21st. In LaPorte, April 26th in Hammond, and April 27th in Crown Point. So we're trying to make these screenings accessible for all across NWI. But what can be expected is we'll host a screening, which is about a 30-minute documentary. And after the screening, we'll have some refreshments available, as well as a discussion with community leaders. And at each event, we have different community leaders. And so if somebody was wanting to attend all four events, they would be able to get a different experience at each of those events. But by including these community leaders in this panel discussion, we're hoping to really bring these issues home to Northwest Indiana and show that this is an issue and a problem that we're facing in our region as well. And it's a pretty big problem.
And Becca, for community members that are interested, how can they register for the event?
So these film screenings, the registration will be available on our website at nwifoodcouncil.org/events.
The NWI Food Council is a grassroots organization that launched in December 2015 with support from NERPC, Valpo Law, Food Bank of Northwest Indiana, as well as Purdue Extension. The council serves all of Northwest Indiana, Lake, Porter, LaPorte, Newton, Jasper, Stark, and Pulaski counties. Back in Virginia, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking, sharing all of the information about NWI Food Council, as well as the upcoming film screenings.
Thanks so much for having us, Dee. We've enjoyed it a lot.
For more information on how to register for the upcoming screenings of the film The Working Hungry, as well as information on the NWI Food Council, you can visit www.nwifoodcouncil.org. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. There's no need to deny it. We are facing an education crisis in America. The state of education has been at the forefront of many public debates the last few years. Everyone, from parents to politicians, have made it a point to offer their opinions on what should and should not be taught in the classroom. Teachers are often overworked, underpaid, feel unsupported, and quite frankly, many are contemplating leaving the profession altogether. The new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession, challenges the reader to look deep, to truly understand what goes on inside the classroom. The book follows three teachers across one school year, a math teacher in the South, a special education teacher in the West, and a middle school teacher on the East Coast, to weave an infuriating and heartbreaking story. Joining us now to talk about her new book is New York Times bestselling author, award-winning journalist, and education expert, Alexandra Robbins. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you.
Alexandra, where do we even begin? Chapter 1 of your book opens with a quote from a Maryland school administrator, and it really sets the tone for the ride the reader is about to embark on. It says, and I quote, "Long-term subs are really hard to find, so I need you to not get really sick or pregnant this year, end quote. All I could think as I read those lines is, wow, buckle up. This is about to be a bumpy ride. In full transparency, I'm married to a career public school educator, and so I have been privy to a firsthand account to stories similar to the ones you shared in your book. Now, before we get into your latest book, The Teachers, which shines a light on the crisis in America's school system right now, I want you to take a moment to talk about yourself, your storied career, as well as some of your work that our listeners may be familiar with.
Well, I'm an investigative journalist. I usually end up on the education beat. I wrote a book called Pledge, The Secret Life of Sororities. I've written about fraternities. I've written about high school students doing the college admissions process, high school student outsiders. I wrote a book called The Nurses. My style is basically, it's nonfiction, but it's the kind of nonfiction I like to read. It's sort of fast-paced, fun-to-read fiction-style stories that follow people throughout a year. So with The Teachers, I wanted to write a book that was really interesting to read and that people would be able to find characters to root for and relate to, that also showed them what's really going on inside schools, and that shows teachers they're deeply appreciated, they're not alone, and people will fight for them. I wanted the book to be the kind of thing that people can give teachers as a gift to show them their support and appreciation, especially now, during one of the hardest months of one of the most difficult years to be a teacher.
So as I shared, I am in fact married to a teacher, and again, I must say your new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession, does an excellent job of lucidly illustrating the realities of teaching over the last few decades. In the book, you pinpoint exactly when the shift began, and as a result, while duties and responsibilities continue to pile on and on, there is really no concession made in terms of additional planning hours, access to additional talent and or resources, and so on to help teachers manage it all. So let's talk about what some of your research revealed that ultimately can lead to, and in many instances, led to teacher burnout.
Okay, so teacher burnout is something I talk about because I think it's a really misleading term. So the teaching profession started declining in the early 2000s. As you said, when districts started piling on and piling on and piling on, it started with the government's focus on high-stakes standardized testing, which really changed the game for teachers because suddenly their paychecks and their jobs could hinge on how their students happened to do on one specific test on a random day. And it didn't matter to the scores, you know, if a child was well-fed or had parental involvement or was neglected at home or had just experienced a trauma or really just like came to school with a stomach ache. You never know what those test scores, and yet teachers were being judged on them. That sort of started this competitive atmosphere of fear. And even though now there aren't as many punitive measures with these tests, the high-stakes tests still exist, and districts have now been piling these responsibilities on teachers for about 20 years. So burnout. Teachers are said to burn out when they are stressed or exhausted from overwork. And teacher burnout is so popular that the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, the definition of burnout, both contextual examples mention teachers. However,
wow.
Experts say that teacher burnout is caused by inadequate workplace supports and resources, high-stakes testing, unmanageable workload, things like that. But instead of fixing these issues like normal workplaces would do, school systems don't. They put it on the teachers. They say, oh, well, the teachers should just do a better job of self-care, and you can't see, but I'm air quoting here because it's such a common phrase, self-care. Yeah. So the phrase teacher burnout, it blames teachers for not being able to cope instead of blaming the school systems that are setting teachers and students up to fail. So that's why I say, instead of saying teachers have the highest burnout levels, we should be saying school districts are the employers who are worst at providing employees with the proper supports and resources.
Wow, I, you know what? I never looked at it like that. And I love the way you illustrated that so eloquently. Now, I want to share with you, Alexandra, that the book actually gave me a gut punch as well. As I am fully aware of the demands that come with teaching, I selfishly complain on Sunday evenings whenever my husband spends those last few moments of our off day doing what? Working on lesson plans for the week, or grading papers, or even quite frankly, just sitting in his office, head in his hands as he tries to give himself a pep talk to prepare for the week ahead. In the book, The Teachers, you are keen to point out that teachers really don't have the plush work schedule with summer vacations, holidays off, and half days that other professions envy. The quote-unquote off days are really days spent in professional development, curriculum planning, assignment grading, and so on, right?
Right. Teachers only have maybe 50 minutes of planning time per day in school. And for some reason, they're expected to do all their grading and planning and prepping in that 50 minutes. That 50 minutes is often eaten up by meetings with other teachers, meetings with administrators, meetings with students, having to call parents because of some behavioral issue or academic issue or something else. Those precious planning time minutes, they end up, I don't know, let's say you get maybe 5 or 10 minutes out of that total. So there is no possible way for teachers to complete their job during their paid contractual hours. That's why teachers are working late into the night. You know, high school and middle school teachers, they can easily have 180 students. I spoke to a teacher in Utah who had 263 students one year. She was a high school English teacher. Can you imagine having to grade, refine, edit, and correct the writing of 263 student essays every time you have to do an assignment? I mean, it's mind-boggling. There's not enough time for teachers to get the job done in the hours that they are paid for.
Wow, 263 papers that you would have to grade. Just wrap your mind around that. That is just...
Every couple of weeks.
Right, every couple of weeks. It's not once a year. It's not for a final only or a midterm. It's, because you want to continue to develop the student. So that is amazing. Now, Alexandra, I wanted to spend some time with you today talking about another peril that teachers face in the ongoing and competing battle to effectively manage the classroom. And that is what one of your chapters focuses on, and that is parental aggression. You talk about the viewpoint that some take that the student is the customer or the I pay you taxes so you work for me approach as a major roadblock for educators. And even more, the last few years we have seen parents take a quite vocal approach at school board meetings, even demanding more input on curriculum. But many of our listening audience may not realize the amount of pressure that parents put directly on teachers. Chapter 2 of the book, for instance, looks at some of what I would consider unbelievable messages that parents have sent to teachers regarding their student. Now, it's one thing to advocate on behalf of your student if you believe they are not receiving equitable access to resources, but it's another thing to commandeer, as we've spoken about earlier, the time of a teacher, especially their personal time, by insisting that they respond to your demands at any hour, day or night. You know, some parents can send messages like, "Hey, Mr. Pre-K teacher, I believe my little Johnny is the best and the brightest. And what are you doing to ensure he receives an A for his recital of the alphabet song?" Or, "Mr. Chemistry teacher, can you please send me your notes from your presentation that you gave to the class? Send those notes to me directly so that my student can do better." Now, these examples, they seem kind of impossible or improbable, but they are really not far from reality, correct?
Oh, gosh, they happen every day. Teachers get so much. It's not about feedback. As you said, it's okay if you need to advocate for your child. But there's this micromanaging that parents are trying to do, some parents are trying to do, of teachers that they just assume that teachers have more time and I guess don't have a life. You know, teachers told me about outrageous parents' emails, parents saying appalling things to them, parents demanding meetings to get their kids 96% bumped up to a 97%.
There's this
idea that teachers can be blamed for anything that goes wrong in schools. Michigan parents said at a conference to a high school English teacher, "We promised our son we'd buy him a car if he gets all A's and B's. Your class is the only class he's getting a C in, so it's your fault he can't get a car for his birthday."
Oh, wow.
I mean, come on.
Wow.
There's, you know, and here these teachers are skilled professionals who are trained and certified to educate students. And we need to let them do that without second-guessing them. Just because a parent went to school doesn't mean the parent knows what it's like to be a teacher and knows what's necessary in the classroom.
So I had the opportunity to interview Gleneva Dunham, who is the American Federation of Teachers Indiana Union President, before the start of the 2022-2023 school year. And she shared with me in the interview, and I'm paraphrasing, "The same sometimes deplorable conditions, like lack of proper air conditioning, are the work conditions of teachers. And it was in that moment that I actually took a step back and realized that I never looked at the profession from the perspective of the teacher. So have you received feedback sharing that sentiment as well?
Yeah, because I talk about that in the book as well. Rebecca, one of the teachers I followed for a year for the book, she, the heating and air conditioning didn't work in her classroom. And so she has to give the kids, you know, standardized tests and things like that. And it felt like 100 degrees in the classroom. She said students were draped over their desks because it was just heat fatigue. And she and many other teachers keep winter jackets and like tank tops in their rooms because they never know what the temperature is going to be in their classroom. I spoke to a teacher who, she's allergic to rodents, but there were rodents in her classroom that the school couldn't afford to get rid of. And she was an art teacher. She would find them in her art closet. She would find droppings in her desk drawers. Oh. And she was supposed to be the one to clean it up because they just didn't have enough staff to stay on top of all that. Oh. Yeah, the working conditions for teachers are pretty appalling in some cases, and people don't really think about it that way, as you said. They don't realize that, you know, when there's no working water fountain in a school, students don't have that, but neither do teachers. And you can bring your own water bottle, but teachers really don't have time to go to the bathroom during the day. So, you know, there are all sorts of things that people don't realize about teachers, and that's one thing that I hope the book gets across.
You just said something that made me remember a phrase that my husband says quite often. He talks about something called teacher's bladder. And so you just shared, you know, teachers, they don't have that opportunity to go to the bathroom. I had never heard that before, but you just brought that to my remembrance.
Yeah, they have to be camels. Because there's no time. You have to be on. You have to be in your classroom. You have to be supervising the kids. And if you're in elementary school, there's no transition time, except when they go to a special class or something. If you are in middle school or high school, many teachers do not have time in the 5 minutes between the bells to go to the bathroom because kids are asking them questions or they have to prep or the bathroom is nowhere near their classroom or the bathroom near their classroom doesn't work or, you know, it's on and on and on. It's really, they don't have a lot of time to go to the bathroom, to drink water, to eat. And, you know, if you get worked up about something, it's not like they could just go take a walk and compose themselves. They have to be on engaging those kids almost like a performer for 6 to 7 hours a day.
Your new book, The Teachers, in which you spent an entire academic year immersed in the life of a public school educator, which is peppered with teacher confessions, also highlights the passion and the resilience of educators. And you end the book with quotes from teachers sharing their testimonies on why, despite all of the challenges, they still love teaching. Alexandra, as we wrap up our time together, I want to ask you this one question. Do you think those considering the idea of going into public education will be encouraged after reading your book?
Oh, that's a good question. So, a reviewer specifically said, when he, in his published review of the book, he's a retired educator, he said reading the book, it was the first time in 5 years that he missed being in the classroom because the book does convey the joy and the passion and the exhilaration of teaching. You know, teaching itself is this beautiful, heartwarming endeavor. It's really a special, special profession. The problem isn't the moments in the classroom with the students. The problems come from the adults, the parents, the district officials, the administrators, and all that extra nonsense. If we could just get the teaching job to go back to focusing solely on the rewarding, meaningful work of teaching children, then the profession will be back to where it should be, and I think that would fix our broken education system.
Already a New York Times bestseller, you can find Alexandra Robbins' new book, The Teachers, A Year Inside America's Most Vulnerable, Important Profession, wherever paperback books are sold. Alexandra, once again, thank you so much for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you so much for having me.
Alexandra Robbins is the author of 5 New York Times best-selling books and a Goodreads Best Nonfiction Book of the Year. Alexandra is an award-winning investigative reporter who has also been honored for distinguished service to public education. She has written for several publications, including The New York Times, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, and The Atlantic, and has appeared on hundreds of television shows, including 60 Minutes, Today, CBS Mornings, The Oprah Winfrey Show, The View, and The Colbert Report. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for this week. Thanks to our guests, and we'll be back with you next Friday with an all-new show.